Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News, or our monthly housing and economy update with our friend Martin North. How are you today, Martin?
I'm pretty good, thank you. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Weather's starting to change, seeing as we're on opposite sides of the planet, and I got a bit of sun today. It was nice. So how's things over there?
Well, we're into autumn, so we had the first frost earlier in the week. The dogs had never seen frost before, so it was quite amusing watching them go, oh, that's a bit cold.
Yeah. Now, interesting times, as we say, every month, but what are your sort of broad views before we get into the slides?
Well, I guess just to say my heart goes out to all those caught up in conflict, you know, Middle East and Eastern Europe. It's a crazy old world out there, but it's also a crazy old world when you look at the financial markets and what's been going on. And you and I have said consistently over recent times, it's crazy. Well, it's even more crazy. And, you know, we're going to get into some of the weird dynamics. You know, bonds going through the roof in terms of yield, uncertainty everywhere you look, and inflation still raging. So, you know, so many levels of uncertainty, and it makes it very difficult for individuals and homeowners and potential investors to know what to do.
Yeah, I've got some more detailed thoughts I want to share about overseas conflicts and how I think that's going to affect Australia and whatever when we get into some of those slides about migration. So we'll dig into that. But first up here, you've got bond yields going higher, as you mentioned, and I think this is from yesterday, so even higher again today.
Well, that's right. So the 30 is now over 5, and you know, I think the 3 is over 5 now. This is US, of course. You know, remarkable turnaround from where we were. And, of course, there's a big discussion now going on about what's causing it. You know, is it that bonds have got unanchored from, you know, the markets, which is what some people are saying? Is it driven by the fact that the US is printing a lot more money to be able to actually fund the big deficits, particularly now with the extra conflicts that are going on? Is it that people feel they need to be more rewarded for the higher risks in the marketplace? But the net effect of all this is that the costs of money has gone through the roof. And of course, bonds are not just higher in the US, but if you look in Australia, not quite as high, but they've gone up there too, around the world. So this is now a very interesting move. And the other observation is we had a very severely inverted yield curve, meaning that short-term rates were a lot higher than long-term rates. Well, long-term rates are now starting to come up. Now, again, you could argue that's either a sign of a less severe recession ahead, or it's about uncertainty. And I think one of the things I want to highlight is that when you have a level of uncertainty that's very high in the market, yields tend to be consistent across the curve. And so we've got, you know, 5% around short term, 5% around 30 years. That to me signals significant uncertainty.
Yeah, and one thing you said there as well about government spending, I was reading an article about Australia and how it's, I think it's 2% of our GDP, $50 billion is now coming from government spending. So if you think about the levers that the central bank has with interest rates and that QE or money printing, but there's also that relationship between what the government are doing and the central bank. And we've spoken about how that might need to be re-examined, how that works, because you can't have governments just spending like drunken sailors while the central bank are trying to cool the economy down. So that's an interesting dynamic as well.
Well, that's right. We've spoken before about one foot on the accelerator, one foot on the brake. And the fact, of course, is that now governments are having to pay a lot more in terms of interest. You know, there was a long bond yield that was actually issued in Australia quite recently with a very high number on it, much higher than ever before. And what that means is that now investors have many more choices. So maybe you don't need to put your money at risk in the stock market. Maybe you look at some of those alternatives, or even, you know, term deposits, 5%+. So it changes the calibration in terms of risk reward for many investors. And it's interesting, you know, JP Morgan came out today saying, no, investors shouldn't be holding a lot of cash. They should be very much active in the markets and there are good returns there. But of course, they've got a vested interest in having people, you know, working in the markets. Maybe now, you know, cash is not trash.
Oh, well, that's interesting. You say Ray Dalio did a piece on now why cash is king after saying cash is trash just 3 years ago when we were at those record low rates. So that's very true. Yeah.
And then the final point to make, of course, there's a big debate going on now, is 2% the right inflation target? You know, should that be lifted, which would mean that rates don't have to be lifted anymore? That there's still some discussion about how much higher central bankers will have to lift rates because of inflation. So, you know, we're not out of this yet. But the world has changed dramatically. And you think back over the last 2 years when we had ultra low interest rates. Now we've got rates that are actually much more like they were in the 70s, 80s and 90s. Of course, they weren't actually very positive economic sort of decades for many people, particularly with the very high inflation that we had there. So watch with space.
Yeah. The inverse relationship between bond yields and their prices. You've just got the chart of the price of bonds themselves.
Yeah, it is worth just stressing because, of course, people get confused between yields, which has gone up, and the face price of bonds. Because, of course, at the end of the life of a bond, you always get back the face value of the bond. And it's worth just noting that anybody, any organization, any bank who bought bonds a few years ago are now sitting on significant paper losses because the value of those bonds have gone down. Now, through the reporting season in the US, which has just been working through, some of the banks were saying, well, we do have unrealized losses on our balance sheet because of the bond movements, but we don't have to crystallize those losses because we can hold the bond to maturity. Now, the question is that really true, or are there financial organizations around the world, and maybe other organizations, sitting now on paper losses, and will those losses have to be crystallized if in fact these interest rates stay longer than people were expecting? You know, a short-term blip, maybe you can cover it, but maybe we've got to the point now where some of these losses are going to have to be crystallized, which means you've got to question the strength of many of the balance sheets of many of our financial institutions.
Yeah, well, a couple of points from me here. For people at home, the easiest way to understand this is if you bought in 2020 here, the bonds when interest rates were low, obviously now you can get 5%. So why would you want to hold a bond that's not getting that yield? So the price that drops. But as Martin said, with products even like the bond ETF, if investors actually want to have redemptions and you need to sell at face value, these kind of things are where you might have to crystallize those losses. Or what's happening with these emergency rescue schemes in the US where the Fed's saying, well, look, even though the face values will pay you the original price or whatever to help banks recapitalize. And so it's another bailout that's happening in the background to the tune of higher and higher numbers every week and month. So, you know, under the water, there's all these bailouts happening and money printing, but they're saying, oh, no, that's not money printing. Oh, no, it's not QE. It's different again. But this is happening for the reasons that Martin just outlined.
Yeah, and the longer it goes on, the worse it's going to get. And it's worth just reflecting, of course, we have central banks that are in the same position. So central banks are actually underwater as well. And, of course, they're underwritten by governments. So, you know, this has a very significant impact on the global structure of finance. And remember that there's so much debt out there. My view is that we're going to see some cracks ahead.
Yes, I agree. So the stock markets have continued to have a pretty tough time, and it's really being just held up by those handful of mega cap sort of tech stocks and that.
Yeah, that's right. So this is just a couple of the indices in the US, and you know, we've not seen significant momentum. But if you strip out the, you know, the big six or big seven, depending on who you put in there, other stocks have actually not performed that well at all. And in fact, if you look around the world, it's pretty much the same story. So stock markets are now going sideways or down. It's worth highlighting that September and October tend to be the worst times in the year. And with the latest news from the Middle East and the latest inflation data, you know, stocks dropped dramatically overnight, more than 1% in some cases. And interestingly, landmark stocks like Tesla dropped significantly because they've had to cut the price of their electric vehicles to try and keep volume up. So stock market's looking pretty wobbly. They're still significantly overvalued based on what I think the future returns are going to be, because I don't think that the returns that are being reported in this reporting season will be replicated. Just to give you an idea, there were a lot of banks in the US who put big provisions in last time around, thinking there's going to be a recession. Now, because there wasn't a recession, they released back some of those provisions. So their results this quarter are much stronger than they should be because of the fact that they undid some of those earlier write-offs. But of course, if the risk in the economy of a recession later is still there, it shows you again that many earnings are probably overstated as to what's going to happen. So I think markets probably will go sideways or down for the next few weeks at least.
The other thought experiment I like is if unemployment starts to rise, you know, what are people going to do? And the reality is that most people these days are going to spend more time staring at Facebook and Instagram or watching YouTube, or Netflix just had a massive beat in earnings last night, or they might get a job, pick up an easy job in Uber and part of the gig economy. So it's almost like that money can still continue to move to those couple of big tech names or to that, those certain places and away from all these other small businesses and whatnot that are going to be the ones that suffer.
Well, there's no doubt that the new economy stocks are going to do quite a lot of the heavy lifting. But a lot of people are now saying, well, maybe it's time to go into defensive stocks. So things like utilities, for example, which people always have to have access to, or maybe look at some of the old manufacturing stocks who've been deeply discounted. So there's a big debate among stock managers as to, do you continue to back those techs who've done quite well, although Tesla and a few others have come back, Nvidia as well have come back a bit, or do you look up for some of those others that have actually underperformed and may perform later? But it comes back to this fundamental question that you've highlighted. In a recession, things change. Are we going to get a recession or not?
Yeah. Okay. So the US consumer is still strong, but I believe they're drawing down on their savings faster than Australians are.
Yeah, it's a very interesting set of data. So the first is, this is not inflation adjusted. So people are spending more. If you actually overlay inflation on the top, in fact, US consumers are not spending more. In other words, they're buying the same things they were buying previously. They're not buying more. Discretionary spending is down. The savings ratios have dropped significantly. Interestingly, what's also happening is that some of those consumers in the US are now putting more money back into treasuries and other forms of more secure returns, including term deposits. So there's some changes there as well. So I don't think that the US consumer is as strong as these headline numbers. And if you look at it on a segmented basis in different types of people, again, what you've found is that there's a proportion of people doing quite well, they're still spending, but there's a very large proportion now who are not spending. They've also got higher college debts now to start repaying and other things too. And of course, higher interest rates, as we'll come onto in a second. So I think US consumers probably will continue to roll over in inflation-adjusted terms in the months ahead.
And that's interesting heading into an election as well, how they might get handout or something to sway some votes.
Plus, of course, we have the situation where you don't have a speaker in the House at the moment. And we have all of these issues with regard to the deficit and all those things. So the US political system is also under significant pressure at the moment. And all of those things together suggest that the next election is going to be a significantly interesting event to watch from the sidelines.
Yeah. So inflation's rolled over but still not beat in the US.
Yeah, so this is just the headline and the core. And, you know, they're still high. But what's interesting, there were two factors that were driving it. Firstly, of course, we had oil prices going up, and so there was higher, you know, gas prices. But also, very importantly, shelter costs were very significantly adding to inflation. And in fact, that includes rents. So rentals in the US are still going up, and there's a difference between headline rents and the one in the CPI for all sorts of reasons that we probably won't get into technically speaking. But the other thing is that cost of hotels went through the roof too. So people are actually, you know, taking trips. That's over the summer there, of course. And so what happened there was that the costs of hotel rooms and accommodation went up. And of course, that's also linked then to the costs of wages, because a lot of workers are actually being paid quite a lot more than they were previously. So the inflation story is actually significantly probably higher than people expected. And whilst people tried to make various arguments as to, well, this could be a blip, it could be a one-off, and, you know, we expect to see more reductions later, it comes back to what's going to happen to housing and what's going to happen to rents and what's going to happen to services wages.
Just on that, Martin, we did get some good comments last month. We asked anyone that was on the front lines about that converting hotels and commercial real estate into residential, and there were some good comments around how the amenities and the infrastructure and whatnot, it's certainly not an easy process and an expensive one if government go down that path as well. Yeah.
No, yeah, that's a very good point. Although I did actually have a couple of feedbacks through my channel, which said that, that they've actually been involved in a couple of projects where it's already happening, and the scoping of the changes and the infrastructure support. If you think of an office accommodation block, you know, already had lots of people in it, right? So they already have access to the various services. So depending on the particular scenario, it is not necessarily such a big ask, but it does depend on the building and, as you say, the context.
Okay, that's interesting, something to read more about.
Yep.
So housing stronger than expected in the US, and I guess in Australia, a lot of places we're starting to see back to record highs, even with interest rates at 20, 30 year highs on mortgages.
Yeah, so this is housing starts. You know, it's very interesting. We're getting a lot of new things happening. By the way, building approvals in Australia are still low, but the completion rates are actually much slower. So it's taking a lot longer to get stuff built, and that's true in Australia, it's true in the US. Why? Because the cost of materials are still quite elevated, but very importantly, labor is not very accessible. So we've got a lot of half-finished building projects around the place. If you take Australia, for example, Home Builder was a very big catalyst for a lot of people moving to homeland packages, and now 2 or 3 years later, a lot of those are still half-built. You know, in Australia, a lot of builders have actually gone out of business. And that means that now people are struggling to try and find an alternative builder to complete the project. We also have got high-rise projects that are taking a lot longer to complete. And the other interesting observation is that the quality of the construction, I think it's true in the US as well as here, is being degraded to try and keep the cost down, being degraded because the cost of materials and the quality of materials is lower, and also the fact that you're sitting with half-built buildings exposed to the weather, and that has long-term consequences. So there's a real interesting question here about how this plays out over the long term, but a lot of half-built stuff that isn't completed.
Or quality being cut, but people cut corners. You know, some builders go, I'm making a lot of money at the moment, we've got to pump out as many as we can, and then obviously all those things that play out. So
absolutely, that's right. And in Australia, the quality of recent construction is shocking, actually. And how long will those buildings survive is a really interesting question. Now, you know, after 5 years, some of them need major renovations, and we've heard of a few examples where in the high-rise sector, the corporate entity that's responsible for maintaining the building can't put the fees up sufficient to cover the cost of the repairs of a five-year-old building. And in fact, some of them are going out of business as a result, which creates huge pressure for those potential investors or occupiers of those buildings. It's a real mess.
Okay, so what will the Fed do? The market's starting to price in another future hike.
Well, possibly, but maybe not. You know, it's difficult to know, and exactly, there's a real big split between what the markets are saying and what other economists are saying. Some people think that the Fed will just sit there on the sidelines because the Fed recently, in the Fed speaks, a lot of the people from the Fed come out and talk. One of the things they made the point was, we don't need to do anything on rates because, in fact, the bond market's doing our work for us. You know, because the rates are going so much higher, that's actually putting more brakes on the economy, so we can just sit on the sidelines and do nothing. Now, others say, no, the Fed needs to actually lift rates higher. And the dot plot that came out last time it came out, suggesting there'll be at least one more rate hike before this end of the cycle. So it's hard to know. There's more data coming out before the Fed decision, early next month. My own view is it is quite likely that the Fed will lift again.
Okay, so mortgage applications and home ownership back to 1995 levels.
Yeah, so this has consequences. And look at the bottom one. This is the mortgage rate. So the mortgage rate in the US, and in fact this was yesterday's chart, that's got about 8%. So mortgages, remember that mortgages in the US are fixed for a 30-year term. So anybody who wants to get a new mortgage is now going to be locked in about 8% for 30 years. No wonder, therefore, that people decide not to put their property in the market, stay where they are, sit on the existing mortgage that they've got, which was a lot lower. So no surprise then that applications for new mortgages has dropped. It's down a bit in the UK, but this is a very significant drop in the US. And it's because of the impact of these higher rates. So, and an 8% mortgage for 30 years brings tears to my eyes.
Yeah, it does. I guess that is an effective way of slamming the brakes on, though, for stopping new people getting in versus Australia and other places.
Well, and we'll show you in a second that, in fact, in Australia, rates have gone up even more than in the US relative to most people. So, yeah, this is a big deal. And it then comes on to the next question. So what is the impact on the banks? And interestingly, as I said earlier on, the banks have been reporting. Not all banks are the same. So some banks are more exposed to the retail sector in the US, some more on the wholesale sector. So some of them who are more exposed, like JP Morgan, did quite well in their trading income. But those who are actually exposed on the retail side, like Wells Fargo, did less well. But the Morgan Stanley result that came out yesterday dropped their shares significantly. And what we're beginning to see now is a big variation in the performance of banks and the share price of banks. And if you look at Morgan Stanley, you know, they're back to lows that we've seen, you know, some time back. And in fact, if you look over the longer term, bank indices are way down. So people are now beginning to question, how strong and secure are the banks? How will they be able to perform into the future? And that's true. So in Australia, if you look at some of the bank stocks in Australia, they're actually also now, you know, not performing that well. Their margins are being compressed. They're being forced, because of market pressure, to discount mortgages to get new people in, but also have to pay more on deposits. So margin compression at a time when the funding costs are very high suggests to me that we're going to see significant pressure on many banks' performances around the world. And as I said at the top, the bond question and how that links back into the underlying structure of the bank's balance sheets is now a very important issue.
Yeah, I think Chris Joy did a good article this month arguing that bank stocks in Australia are still possibly 17% overvalued. Yep. And the constituents of some of their funding with these hybrid products, he was talking about who, like, how it's a bit of a grey area between APRA and ASIC, because these products can tail less sophisticated investors and whatnot. But another thing to think about for people with those banks that need the overseas funding or funding from these products that might be cracked down on more, so that becomes more expensive and they've got to pass the cost on to customers, and all these flow-on effects that cause inflation to be sticky.
Yeah, and we are seeing a number of bank redundancies as well around the place. So, you know, people are actually shrinking that, because, you know, people are one of the big variable costs in the banking sector. So we are seeing some redundancies there. We're also seeing increasing in fees. So we're seeing little subtle fees coming back in. And we're also seeing, like, CBA, for example, who's dropped market share for the first time in the mortgage sector over the last month or so, because they actually refuse to play ball with these cash discounts for people who are actually being brought into the market. The final point on the mortgage industry in Australia, it's worth noting, there are a lot of very cheap attractor offers for new mortgage borrowers, but those are only for a year. And then the rates go a lot higher. And so people need to read the small print and don't just take the headline number as to what that rate might be. You need to look at it slightly more in a more sophisticated fashion, because a lot of people could be caught. And it's worth remembering, in the US, we had the global financial crisis, and we had a lot of people who were on low rates suddenly went up to high rates because they'd actually been locked into products that weren't actually as good as perhaps what they appeared when you looked at just the headline number.
Yep. All righty, moving on. So UK is still in worse shape than the US.
Yeah, so the UK, in fact, the inflation number came out again. It's the same as previously. The GDP was up very slightly, but they've restated the definition of how GDP works in the UK to try and actually make it a little better than it was. They were performing the worst in Europe. Now they're claiming not to be. So it depends on how you fudge the numbers, I suppose. But the UK has got some significant issues. And wages growth was also quite strong. In fact, real wages were moving slightly faster than inflation in the UK for the first time. But that, of course, might be an issue for the Bank of England, because they're still worrying about the rate of inflation. It's still well above target. But there are consequences. And if you look at the next slide, one of the really interesting things to look at is the asking price versus sale price. And we're starting to see that drop now. So in the UK, real estate is coming off. There was a bit of a significant sort of splurge post-COVID, but it's now reversing. And so we're not seeing dramatic falls, but we're seeing some reductions in value in some parts of the country. And it's because of this new economics, right? So the costs of a mortgage are a lot higher. The supply of property is pretty limited. Building and construction are under difficulty, so the supply is also a problem. And of course, there's strong migration in the UK as well. So all those things there, but you're seeing prices beginning to ease. Now, interesting question is this a forward indicator of what may be happening in Australia? And we'll touch on that in a moment or two.
Yeah, so in Australia, we talk about the real wages going nowhere for over a decade now.
Well, I keep highlighting this point. You know, the fact is that most people are going backwards in real terms. So if you look at any indicized, in other words, adjusted for inflation, you know, 2010 to now, pretty much there's been no real growth. Now, of course, that's an average. And there are some people who've done really well, particularly if you've been in certain sectors, you know, the resources sector or maybe the finance sector. But in other sectors, people are going backwards in real time. And so the bottom line is this, that we're not seeing at the moment in Australia a significant rise in any income growth in real terms. Now, that's a problem because, of course, people have got significantly higher expenditures, particularly if you've got big mortgages and with interest rates rising and the resets and everything else. So this is a really big pressure on households. And there's no evidence at the moment that things are turning around. So in real terms, people are still going sideways or backwards.
Yep. Unemployment set to rise just when we've got immigration at, 400,000 people.
Yeah, so the data came out overnight and, unemployment rate dropped to 3.6%. People were expecting it to rise to 3.8%, so it dropped slightly. But the reason it dropped was because the ratio of people actually working dropped. So in other words, there were more people who were out of the market. But it's just worth understanding, with the migration settings that we've got at the moment, and it's hugely high relative to any time previously, we need to create more than 30,000 new jobs every month just to keep the unemployment rate where it is, right? Now, this time around, the new jobs created were in the tens of thousands rather than 30,000. And we've not seen a period where we've been able to create consistently more than 30 to 35,000 jobs a month. So there's almost no way that we're going to be able to see the unemployment rate stay where it is. It's going to rise. And so the question is, how much will it rise? When will it rise? And what are the implications? And of course, we've still got this massive flood of people coming into the country who are competing for jobs with Australians, who potentially sometimes are going to be prepared to work for lower wages because they just want to get into the country. And so we've got this massive pressure on the economy at a time when the unemployment rate is going to rise. Even the RBA says it's going to rise. The question is how high, how quickly, and what will the implications be?
Yeah, and this is, I guess, the point I want to make. When we see these overseas conflicts and things like that, we forget sometimes that Australia is such a multicultural country that there's relatively large representations from these regions. And so in this divisive world we live in, where the mainstream media and social media, you know, play on people's emotions to divide you on every issue, next thing you know, we've got, you know, people in the streets having these protests or whatever for all these issues. And the more global issues there are, the more we're going to see these factions of people in Australia, a country where so many people do live in the cities compared to other places as well. So, you know, it's been a pretty great place to live. But if all this stuff continues, I think relative to other places, we're going to see a lot of unrest. And then people, obviously, racism can increase when people see, oh, well, the overseas immigration people are competing for me for my job or my house or whatever it is. So these are sometimes things that aren't unspoken about that I like to think about.
I think it's a very important point, Alex. And the other point is that, the strategy is now to build higher and closer together and basically build smaller. So you've got more people on top of each other. And so if you look at the population densities and if you look at what the implications of that are, people have less space to roam around, more congested traffic. If you try and drive around Sydney these days, it's crazy. You know, you're moving slower than you were in the horse-drawn age. You know, it's ridiculous. I mean, there are so many consequences of this massively high migration. And interesting, there was an argument put up last week saying, well, we need to import more builders to be able to help build the houses for the new migrants that are coming in. And I'm thinking, hang on a moment, that's a bit recursive, isn't it? Bring more people in so you get more builders to build more houses or apartments for the people that are coming in. I mean, hang on. We should be looking very seriously at this migration question, I think, because, you know, you're right. There's a very strong multicultural society in Australia, but there is a risk it could be destabilized with what's going on at the moment and with massively high migration.
Maybe it was that a politician, Martin? Only politicians could think like that in terms of the recursive builders to build more buildings.
Yeah. That's crazy, isn't it?
Okay. So RBA talking about pressures on some household sectors.
Yeah. So this was the statement of monetary policy that came out quite recently. And it's just worth reflecting that now the RBA is recognizing that some people are actually in the situation where their cost of living are actually beyond their income. Now, they're saying if you apply the household expenditure measure calculation, which is the very sort of baseline calculations that the banks use, it could be as much as 13% of households that are actually underwater. My argument would be, well, the HEM is not a very good proxy for what's really going on. So I use my own stress numbers, as you may know, and I say half of those with a mortgage are now having difficulty, and 70% of those in rent. But the RBA is recognising that there's a problem now. And so what that means is one fifth of households potentially are going to have significant issues. The other way of looking at it was, where is the savings buffers, the mortgage buffers? And what the RBA says is about 40% of households who effectively have less than 3 months buffers. So if these rates continue to go higher or stay higher for longer, over time this is going to get significantly worse. So now finally the RBA is starting to talk about the pressures that I've been seeing under the water for a long, long time. Probably too late to do much about it now, because the RBA won't be able to cut rates because inflation is still too high. But the fact is, we have more people now struggling. They're working more hours. They're working more jobs if they can do that. But nevertheless, cash flow is a real problem now.
Yeah, I think I was reading that with those savings buffers, like more than half of it is owned by people over 55 that have probably, you know, paid off their mortgage and whatnot. Yep. And for the savings buffers to be worn down sometime around March for the majority of people, and then to get that up to 60 to 80% of people, and that other 20%, the wealthy, you know, they're not going to be affected. Doesn't matter what inflation really gets to, because they've got that such an excess of savings and assets. Mm-hmm. That just kind of shows that what's going to happen for these people that get kicked out of their homes or whatever it is. Well, it just means that the wealthy can afford to scoop up more houses at what they see at a relative discount and whatnot. So I think it exposes these fundamental flaws in our financial system that hasn't really been questioned for a generation now, with lower interest rates and easy money settings.
No, you're right. Well, the idea has been let the market sort it out. But the fact is that what you find is that there's a proportion of people are getting significantly more affluent, you know, unable to actually, as you say, hoover up cheap assets when they come up for sale. There's another bunch that are actually excluded completely from the property market already. And there are people in the middle who are struggling to pay those mortgages and struggling to sort of, you know, just get by. And they're finding it harder and harder. The gradient is getting worse and worse. Inflation is still there. Wages are not growing, really. And unfortunately, the politicians they play lip service to a lot of this, but actually they're not really thinking about it in a way that holistically is going to deal with it. So we've got this massive polarization in the economy between the haves and the have-nots, the affluent and the less affluent. And over the last decade or so, that polarization has got significantly worse. And I'll show you in a couple of slides just how much it really has.
Yep. So investors continue to exit their investment properties?
Yeah, so this is another very interesting observation. So with returns, real returns on term deposits, and you know, in the markets, 5, 6, 7%, many property investors saying, well, I can't get anything like that on a net return basis for my investment property. And in fact, this article in the AFR was finally highlighting what I've been seeing in my surveys for about 6 to 8 months. A lot of property investors, particularly those with the high-rise apartments that have not done well over the last 4 or 5 years and are unable to lift the income by lifting the rent, they've got mortgage rates going through the roof, so they're selling. So we're seeing significant numbers of listings of investment properties in some of our major urban centres. And some of those are relatively small shoebox-type properties, poorly maintained in some cases, and yet they're available. What's interesting is that some of them are being hoovered up by those more affluent people that we were just discussing, who can say, well, I'll just add another investment property, I'll hold it for the long term. We've also got some overseas people buying some of these investment properties. There are some, though, being bought by first-time buyers because they're desperate to buy anything. And my worry is that some of those first-time buyers are actually effectively buying a dog. It might be cheap, but there's a reason why it's cheap, and therefore it may not be the deal that may first appear. And I've unfortunately seen a number of first-time buyers who haven't done their own due diligence, are just piled in because the price was right, and then regretting at their leisure that they bought into a high-rise apartment where the surcharges have gone through the roof, where the maintenance of the property is very much under pressure, and where effectively the property they've got is not going to be very fit for purpose. So there's a real problem here. But finally, the mainstream media are now recognizing that property investors are actually leaving in droves.
Yeah, and as we spoke about before, some of those poorer quality buildings, the service and maintenance costs, and it's just all the stress of trying to get tenants and stuff, it's just not worth the risk. If you can get 5% in your savings account, or if you're more financially savvy or a sophisticated investor, easily get 6 or 7% on some of these high-grade investment bonds and bank bonds and that type of thing. So this is what the smart minds are talking about. It's the first time in decades that these assets have been radically repriced due to risks, and it hasn't flown through just yet, as you say, and people are still thinking that maybe this is a great buy. And the other thing I read was I think we're up to 1/5 of all these property funds now that have halted withdrawals because there's not the liquidity there. Investors want to take out their money, but they can't sell these buildings. And as you mentioned, some of these affluent investors might go, oh, well, I'll put a bid in 20% below what they're asking. And that for them, you know, that's the bear market. They don't have to wait years for it to play out. They're happy. But that means all these investors that think that their net asset value is X is actually Y 20% lower. So that's something that continues to happen.
Yeah. And the other point there is a lot of renters are struggling because, of course, the rents have gone up. So they're looking to try and get into the market. And so they're almost the cannon fodder to buy these cheap, deep discounted properties. But there's a reason why they're cheap. Right. And so what I keep saying is to prospective first time buyers, certainly look around and see what's available, but be really, really cautious because you can really end up buying a dog. And, you know, a bit like in the UK where we had significant price falls. And then 20 years later, 15 years later, post the global financial crisis, people are still in negative equity because prices have not recovered in those areas. So you need to be really careful and understand the dynamics locally. As I always say, you've got to go granular.
Yeah. Okie dokie. So mortgage exposure by country?
Yeah, it's just worth highlighting that the change in policy rates has been pretty extreme around the world. Australia, though, is up there. And why? Because we have a greater proportion of people on variable rate mortgages. And of course, mortgage rates here have shot up through the roof. And the fact is that in other countries, particularly the US, for example, there are these fixed term 30-year mortgages, which means a lot of people are still on low rates. Whereas in Australia, particularly with the mortgage cliff and those switching out from fixed to variable rates, there are more people now on significantly higher rates. So one of the reasons that's put forward too is to suggest that's why the RBA doesn't need to move rates as high, because we have a more direct correlation between cash rate and mortgage rates because of the variability. And we'll see whether that plays out. The other point to make though, and this is the sort of slightly more strategic point, if you look at the OECD data, Australia is sliding down the list in terms of the proportion of the population who own outright. We have a lot more people with a bigger mortgage, so they tend to get a mortgage later in life and for longer, which means, of course, that the winners in all of this are the banks, because effectively what it means is that you are paying more interest to the banks over a longer period of time. And unfortunately, these days, you need two incomes rather than one. Their income multiples are significantly worse than they used to be, which means that you're actually in real cash terms now paying 35, 40, 45% of your income on your mortgage. And yet, despite that, despite the reach to try and get into the market, overall, we're sliding down the list. And the proportion of people who own property outright continues to degrade.
It's another one of those cycles that feeds into itself a bit, Martin, isn't it? Because property's been such a great performer in Australia, we've seen the percentage of our economy and GDP that comes from property and the banks just continue to grow. And we just don't have this diversity. And then you don't end up with other startups or ideas or industries like other countries have. And it just proportionally continues to go more and more into property, which is great on the way up, and not so much if conditions change like we're seeing now.
Yeah, and you know, the property black hole, as I talk it, you know, the event horizon, it sucks in more and more and more of the economy and more of the cash from the banks. People spend more and more of their income trying to get into property. And as you say, it means you don't invest in new startups or new ideas. And in fact, if you look at all the international comparators, the Australian economy is one of the narrowestly based of all. Okay, we dig stuff up and sell it overseas. And then we've got this massive property sector. But it doesn't necessarily all go well for, you know, a buoyant economic future.
And just that other point that we spoke about before, the US at 5.2% with their neutral estimates of inflation at 2.6. So they're double what they say is the neutral estimate. Whereas in Australia, the neutral is 3.8, but we're only at 4.1.
Yeah.
And so these are the things where you can't hit the brakes as hard in Australia because of the property and different how the the only lever that central banks can pull is actually has so different effects in the different countries, depending on the makeup of your economy and banks and property and that type of thing.
No, that's exactly right. And of course, the other point there is that we've got high petrol prices into Australia. With the exchange rate dropping, that's putting prices up even higher. So the cost of filling up is rising. The costs of other things, for example, electricity and gas are still quite high. And so there are a bunch of inflationary pressures that we're seeing in the country, in Australia, because of the movement in the exchange rate. And why is the exchange rate lower? Because our interest rates relative to other places are significantly lower.
Okey-doke. So home ownership by age.
Yeah, so I just wanted to sort of pick up that point a bit further. So if you follow the argument that, in fact, less people own outright, the truth is that over the last 40 years, the proportion of people who own property has dropped. It's dropped most at the bottom end. So, age 30 to 34, I think it's 70% down. 25 to 29, slightly lower. But so if you're older, then your ownership rates have not particularly changed. But the other way to think about it is if you look at it, and this is actually from a recent report from Bernard Salt and from AMP, the home ownership rate has dropped. So it peaked at 73% back in 70-71. It's a lot lower. But the ratio of home prices to average wages has gone through the roof. So like I said, people are more leveraged into property, but the settings that we've had for a generation have led to less people owning property. More people with a mortgage, but overall, more people are being thrown into the rental sector, which, of course, if you're an investor, may be good, but if you're an aspiring owner-occupier, not so good. So my argument is we've got a broken housing model here. This isn't just a set of tactical issues around the edge, and you can't solve it by just a bit of social housing here or whatever. This is a real structural issue. Now, I'm rather hoping that maybe the politicians, after the voices sort of kicked on and we move on, will turn to focus on this issue, because for me, this is one of the most strategic, critical structural issues in Australia. However, I fear they may not.
Yeah, so that's the final slide you've put up here, Martin. And something that's been spoken about a little bit, or maybe we've mentioned it before, is not just politicians, but the wealthy that own multiple properties. They're the ones that make the decisions, and the wealthy are the ones that tend to donate to the politicians. So it's very, very hard to ever bring about change. And they're also the ones that own the most bank shares, and the banks are the ones that benefit from more mortgages. So it's just another cycle that feeds into itself.
Yeah, so this data was published quite recently. It was actually a piece of work that had been done where they went through and found all of the interests of politicians, how many politicians have investment properties. And basically, the bottom line is, if you're a politician, you are significantly more likely to have multiple investment properties relative to your average Australian. So the question is, if that's the case, and as you say, they probably have bank shares and other things too, are they really going to do things that would actually potentially drop home prices, make access to property more accessible, maybe reduce the impact of investment properties when they'd actually be cutting off their nose despite their face? And that's the critical question, which I'm going to leave hanging, because I don't know the answer, but why I believe that politicians are probably not going to really tackle the fundamental issues we have around property in Australia.
Well, I guess it's a philosophical thing about the two-party system in general. And I guess in our world, the crypto world, if we can create decentralized systems where you get better, power to the average person sort of thing, how do you change it so that elected people are accountable? Because it's just gone so far away from having these smaller electorates and local economies and that type of thing. It's just the people at the top don't make any changes that actually affect the people at the bottom in a positive way any longer. Yeah.
No, well, that's exactly right. And it's worth just underscoring, it isn't just one side of politics that own investment properties. Both sides of the house and third parties, and smaller parties, they all own investment properties. So it is riddled. And by the way, if you did the same analysis at a state level, you'd find precisely the same too. So the moneyed powered group, which is the banks and the politicians, right, are on the side of big business, on the side of housing, on the side of investors. The question is this good for ordinary Australians? And, is there a better way? And I think there is a better way. But the question is, will those in power ever choose that route? Unless we can apply additional pressure to the politicians. And I think that's got to show that there is an alternative way that could work. We're going to get more of the same old, same old. But this is not actually benefiting ordinary Australians. And that's my problem.
Yeah, I guess on this point as well, go back to the US elections. I think RFK is running as an independent, he's announced, and you know, no one thought that Trump was ever going to get in. But someone like that that's saying, hey, I'm going against the two-party system, something like that plays out, that can really change global politics. So very interesting to watch that next election cycle.
Yeah, as we say, we live in interesting times, Alex, interesting times.
Yes. Well, fantastic chat today, as always, Martin. Hope you guys have liked that one at home. Links to Martin's channel for more regular updates on all this stuff down below, and links to all our crypto research as well, if that's your thing. Larry Fink, Martin, CEO of BlackRock, said Bitcoin is a flight to quality. So I think I tweeted out that they've obviously bought enough Bitcoins to start their ETF, if he's telling people Bitcoin's a flight to quality.
Well, and just worth saying in closing, the SEC, of course, lost their case. So it could well be that we're going to see some ETFs now popping up, and that could, again, change the game.
Awesome. Okay. Thanks, Martin. Thanks, guys. Talk to you again soon. Cheers.